Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Phil Dierking, Pete Musto, and Lucia Milanig. Later, Steve Ember will bring us our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Bangkok, Thailand is known for having some of the best street food in the world. Now, one street seller is being officially recognized for her tasty creations. The roadside restaurant J-Fi in Bangkok was recently awarded a star in the highly respected Michelin Guide to Restaurants Around the World. Officials from the guide visit restaurants and then give them a rating of 1 to 3 stars based on overall quality. J-Fi is like many other street eateries across Bangkok. It serves a variety of Thai dishes in simple surroundings. The owner and main cook is 72-year-old Phai Junsuta. She prepares the food in an open-air kitchen. She does all of the cooking in a couple of large pans called woks and wears special glasses to protect her eyes from an endless stream of smoke. The Michelin Guide describes her restaurant as a place that both taxi drivers and foodies wax lyrical about. It says that some of the restaurant's most popular food items are crab omelets, crab curries, and dried congee. Many restaurants wait years to receive Michelin stars. But Phai Junsuta says she was not aware of the honor before being chosen. "Before, I knew the Michelin name, but I did not know it had to do with cooking," she told Agence France-Presse. "I am very proud." But she added that she would quickly be returning to the kitchen after attending an awards ceremony. "We do not have a lot of staff because I'm a bit difficult and crazy," she said. J-Fi was one of 17 restaurants chosen for the first ever Michelin Guide for Bangkok. 3 of the city's restaurants, serving Indian, French, and European food, received 2 stars. The others, 7 of which are Thai restaurants, received 1 star. Many other eateries, including 28 street food places, are also included in the guide, but they did not receive any stars. In announcing the selections, Michelin said Bangkok has learned how to successfully offer many kinds of international cooking styles without giving up its own food heritage. Thailand's Tourism Authority signed a partnership with Michelin to create the Bangkok Guide. The partnership followed an announcement last year that Thai officials planned to ban street food sellers in Bangkok in an effort to clean up the city. The government later backed away from its plans to completely remove all street food vendors. But officials did tighten some rules to prevent sellers from blocking traffic and people. I'm Brian Lynn.
A new book tries to show what life in Africa is really like after one removes misinformation and some stereotypes found in Western media. The book, called Everyday Africa, presents the major and minor events in life through the images of 30 photographers. It is now available in bookstores across Europe and the United States. The book started as a feed on the social media photo sharing app Instagram. It was a project of two Americans, Peter DeCampo and Austin Merrill. Now, it belongs to a community of Africans across the continent. DeCampo says the project dates back to 2012, when he and Merrill traveled to Ivory Coast to report on the end of its civil war. While speaking with refugees and soldiers about how the country was recovering, the Americans found that daily life was fairly normal for most people. However, they felt this information was not coming through in the story they were preparing.
We were seeing all these other moments that were much sort of truer to our daily life experience in that part of the world.
To capture those events, Merrill said they started using cell phones to take pictures of what they saw around them.
You know, pictures of people going to work or eating breakfast or hanging out with their friends, things that were just more normal everyday scenes, and we felt like there was really something to that and that that might be the most important thing we had to tell about that place at that moment instead of the crisis story.
DeCampo says he feels it is difficult to have an understanding of the world when all you see are extreme stories. The Everyday Africa Instagram feed was a way of seeing what daily life looks like in Africa from many different perspectives. The project is popular and still growing. The Instagram account has over 360,000 followers and an active community of photographers sharing pictures of the continent. With the support of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, DeCampo and Merrill are using the Everyday Africa name to help educate students. They visit middle school classrooms in the United States to train students on how to document their lives and recognize stereotypes. In their visits with students, DeCampo says, they use the story of Everyday Africa's creation to discuss how media representation affects them and their communities. They also show the students how to improve their own photography with the goal of helping them create their own school or community everyday project. DeCampo and Merrill say their dream is for Instagram communities to be formed all over the world, documenting their everyday life. They hope that the book will give them the chance to reach more people and to show an underrepresented side of African life to the world. I'm Phil Dierking.
Fishermen on the northeastern coast of the United States are voicing concerns about the development of offshore wind power. Some of the fishermen are based in New Bedford, Massachusetts. The town was once a major center for whale hunting ships. The city was made famous in Herman Melville's book about whaling, Moby Dick. New Bedford also has been one of the nation's most profitable fishing ports for 17 years. But fishermen there now fear the possibility of having to pilot their boats through many wind turbines to reach their fishing grounds.
The state of Massachusetts wants to build hundreds of the large wind turbines off the coast near New Bedford. The electricity produced would be enough to power more than 1 million homes. Eric Hansen harvests scallops from his boat in New Bedford. His family has been in this business for generations. The 56-year-old spoke to the Associated Press about his concerns. "You ever see a radar picture of a wind farm?" he asked. Hansen added, "Transit through it will be next to impossible, especially in heavy wind and fog." The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is the government agency responsible for dealing with energy issues in federally owned waters. An organization representing East Coast scallop fishermen has taken legal action against the agency. They are trying to stop a proposal for a wind farm of nearly 200 wind turbines off the coast of New York's Long Island. Commercial fishermen in Maryland's Ocean City and North Carolina's Outer Banks have also raised concerns about being unable to reach fishing grounds.
But supporters of the offshore wind power industry say they have learned from Europe's experience with the technology. They also point to the opening of America's only offshore wind farm near Rhode Island. They say it provides evidence that wind farms will not hurt U.S. fishermen. Deepwater Wind is a company based in Rhode Island that opened the 5-turbine wind farm near the state's Block Island. The company is proposing larger wind farms in other places along the East Coast. Matthew Morrissey is a vice president of Deepwater. He told the Associated Press, "We want to do this the right way, and I believe we have a path to do that."
However, fishermen are concerned that offshore wind farms will only lead to more restrictions. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management representative Stephen Boutwell said the agency has taken steps to deal with the concerns of the fishermen. These include banning wind farm development in some areas off Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and New York that are valuable to the fishing industry. The agency also has carried out studies on issues fishermen have raised. This includes questions about the effects of wind farm construction and electromagnetic fields on fish behavior. Deepwater Wind said early findings from studies off its Block Island wind farm show little harm to the environment. The company suggests that fish and lobster populations are just as strong as they were before the wind farm.
The company says it has paid several fishermen who were temporarily unable to reach their fishing grounds during construction. There have not been reports of fishing boats striking the turbines, but several boats have reported their fishing equipment getting damaged by undersea structures connected to the turbines. Richard Fuca is the president of the Rhode Island Fishermen's Alliance. He said problems with wind turbines have cost fishermen tens of thousands of dollars in equipment and lost fishing time. Also, U.S. fishermen are not pleased with the comparison to European fishermen. In Europe, 10 different countries have placed restrictions on fishing around the more than 3,500 turbines off their shores.
U.S. officials and developers, however, say similar bans are not being considered, except during construction. Studies have been done on the North Sea of Great Britain, Germany, the Netherlands, Belgium, and France. They suggest the turbines actually support the growth of sea life. Yet Merlin Jackson of the Thanet Fishermen's Association said in Britain, transit through wind farms remains difficult in bad weather. He said there have been at least 2 cases of fishing boats hitting turbines. Fishermen largely depend on the lights on turbines as guides, but they are not always taken care of well.
Jackson added that America's slower, more complex approval process for turbine construction has forced more questions to be asked. East Coast fishermen seem more united than those in Europe when wind farms are being developed. If fishermen can be organized and be allowed to have input into the earliest parts of the planning process, then there should be a way forward, Jackson said. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Lucia Malonig.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Today we tell the story of how a British attack on Fort McHenry in the port of Baltimore led to the Star-Spangled Banner, America's national anthem. In the summer of 1814, British forces attacked Washington, D.C. They burned the Capitol building, the White House, and other public buildings. Then they withdrew to their ships in the Chesapeake Bay. British General Robert Ross and Admiral George Cockburn led the attack on Washington. Next, they planned to attack Baltimore. But the people of Baltimore expected the attack and began to prepare for it. 50,000 of them built defenses around the city. The port of Baltimore was protected by Fort McHenry. The guns and cannon of the fort could prevent British ships from reaching the city. The British began with a land attack against Baltimore. General Ross, Admiral Cockburn, and about 4,000 British soldiers landed at North Point, a finger of land reaching into the Chesapeake Bay. From North Point, it was a march of about 22 kilometers to Baltimore. The British began marching at about 7 in the morning. General Ross and Admiral Cockburn stopped their men after an hour. The two commanders and several of their officers rode to a nearby farmhouse and forced the family living there to give them breakfast. When the British officers finished eating, the farmer asked General Ross where the British were going. To Baltimore, he answered. The farmer told Ross that he might have some difficulty getting there because of the city's defenses. But the British general replied, "I will eat supper in Baltimore or in hell." When they returned to the march, Ross and Cockburn moved far in front of the British forces. A group of several hundred Americans opened fire on the British officers. Ross was hit. He died soon afterward. The Americans retreated, but they slowed the progress of the British soldiers. It was late the next day before the British force arrived to face the Army of Americans near Baltimore. The Americans were on high ground and had about 100 cannon to fire down on the British. The British commander ordered his men to rest for the night. He sent a message to the British warships to attack the city with guns and mortars. Such an attack, he felt, might cause the Americans to fall back. But the British ships had already been firing at Fort McHenry since early morning. The British guns were more powerful than those of the fort. The strength of their guns let the ships fire from so far away that the American guns could not hit them. Shells and bombs from British mortars fell like rain over Fort McHenry, but few Americans in the fort were hurt or killed. Most of the rockets and shells exploded in the air or missed. Many of them failed to explode. At the center of the fort flew a large American flag. The flag could be seen by the soldiers defending the city and by the British warships. The flag was also seen by a young American named Francis Scott Key. Key was a lawyer who had once thought of a life of religious work. He was also a poet and writer. He opposed war, but he loved his country and joined the army in Washington to help defend it. When the British withdrew from Washington, they took an American doctor named William Beans with them. Francis Scott Key knew the doctor and asked President Madison to request the British commander to release him. President Madison wrote the request, and Key agreed to carry it to Admiral Cockburn. Key also carried letters from wounded British soldiers in American hospitals. In one of the letters, a British soldier told of the excellent medical care he was being given. Cockburn agreed to free the doctor after he read the reports that his wounded men were receiving good medical care. But Cockburn would not permit the doctor or Key or a man who came with him to return to land until after the attack. So Francis Scott Key watched from a British warship as the shells and rockets fell on Fort McHenry. Years later, he said, "I saw the flag of my country waving over a city, the strength and pride of my native state, a city devoted to plunder and desolation by its assailants. I witnessed the preparation for its assaults. I saw the array of its enemies as they advanced to the attack. I heard the sound of battle. The noise of the conflict fell upon my listening ear and told me that the brave and the free had met the invaders." All through the rainy day, the attack continued. Dr. Beans, watching with Key, had difficulty seeing the flag. He kept asking if the stars and stripes still flew above the fort. Until dark, Key could still see it. After that, he could only hope. Britain tried to land another force of men near the fort, but the Americans heard the boats and fired at them. The landing failed. Shells and rockets continued to rain down on Fort McHenry. At times, the fort's cannon answered. That told Key that the Americans had not surrendered. The British troops east of Baltimore spent most of the night trying to keep dry. Commanders could not decide if they should attack or retreat. Finally, orders came from the admiral: withdraw to your ships. A land attack against Baltimore's defenses would not be attempted. At first light of morning, British shells were still bursting in the air over the fort. The flag had holes in it from the British shells, but it still flew. The British shelling stopped at 7 o'clock. Key took an old letter from his pocket, and on it he wrote a poem about what he had seen. Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, or the ramparts we watched, were so gallantly streaming, and the rockets' red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave? Or the land of the free and the home of the brave? Americans sang these words and remembered the attack on Fort McHenry. Then, in 1931, Congress made the Star-Spangled Banner the national anthem of the United States. The unsuccessful British attack on Baltimore was followed by news that Britain had also suffered a defeat to the North. British General George Prevost had led 11,000 soldiers south from Montreal to New York. At Plattsburgh, on the western shore of Lake Champlain, his army was opposed by fewer than 4,000 Americans. General Prevost believed he needed to get control of the lake before moving against the American defenders. He requested the support of 4 British ships and about 10 gunboats. A similar-sized group of American ships also entered the lake. In a fierce battle, the American naval force sank the British ships. The Army decided not to attack without naval support. The 11,000 British soldiers turned around and marched back to Montreal. By the time of these battles, the United States and Britain had already agreed to discuss peace. The peace talks began in the summer at Ghent in Belgium. At first, the British were in no hurry to sign a peace treaty. They believed their forces would be able to capture parts of the United States. Britain demanded as a condition for peace that the United States give large areas of its northwest to the Indians. It also said America must give Canada other areas along the border. And Britain would not promise to stop seizing American sailors and putting them in the British Navy. But British policy at the peace talks changed after the battles of Baltimore and Plattsburgh.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.